So today, I appeal to all Americans, regardless of party, to meet this moment of national and generational importance.
President Biden says democracy is at risk this election. How is his message landing with Democratic voters? It's Thursday, November 3rd, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Kalyani Saxena. Later in the show, we'll hear about the ballot measures to close the 13th Amendment slavery loophole in five states. And the story of Elsie Robinson, the female journalist who became America's most read woman in the early 1900s. But first, President Biden's urgent warning about the state of our democracy. In a speech last night, Biden said that democracy itself was on the ballot, urging politicians to stand against violence and accept the will of voters. So how are core Democratic constituencies like young voters, black voters, and people of color viewing the president's speech? Deepa Fernandez spoke with Peniel Joseph, director of the University of Texas's Center for the Study of Race and Democracy. Peniel, what did you make of Biden's speech last night? His words were strong, but who do you think he was trying to reach with this speech, and do you think that his words spoke to them?
Yeah, I think it's a speech for the base and maybe some independents who are open to sort of the reality of the situation in American politics, not just hyper-partisanship, but a partisanship divide that centers around an authoritarian vision of the United States of America, where the virtues of our democracy are left behind in favor of a winner-take-all strategy that supports minority rule at the expense of voting rights and citizenship and dignity for everyone.
So what part of Biden's speech do you think had the most impact?
Well, I think the part that has the most impact is when he talked about the existential crisis facing American democracy. And then he really told a story. He told a story about, as you've mentioned earlier in the clip, there are people who are running for office who refuse to accept the outcome unless they win, and how that's really virtually unprecedented, not completely unprecedented. And he talked about, this hasn't occurred until the Civil War. And really, technically, it's in the decades after the Civil War. Really, every midterm election was sort of a referendum on whether we would have a multiracial democracy or we would have a kind of racial authoritarianism in the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s, and 1890s. So in a way, we've been here before, but certainly never as this robust democracy, 330 million people with this kind of GDP, this kind of capacity both for enormous good, but also a capacity for enormous violence. So I think the story he told about that we're at this pivotal moment in American history, how those who don't support voting rights and don't support free and fair elections are un-American, and how the average voter should understand that we're not facing a normative or normal election, even though people want to get back to business as usual. I thought that was effective and strong. I think in a way it is playing to his base, because I think his base, including young people, black voters, voters of color, have wanted him to share this message and messaging for a long time. And really, in the last several months, he has much more than his entire presidency.
Yeah. Let's take a listen to another clip. It speaks to exactly what you're talking about. Here, Biden's directly addressing Donald Trump's denial of the election results in his address and the potential for violence.
American democracy is under attack because the defeated former president of the United States refuses to accept the results of the 2020 election. He refuses to accept the will of the people. He refuses to accept the fact that he lost.
You know, when he tied this, Peniel, directly to the fact that, you know, it translates, it's a straight line to the attack that happened on Paul Pelosi, the husband of the Speaker of the House. And I wonder if you think that he was successful in really speaking to some of the core constituencies that we've been hearing maybe won't come out to vote, even though they're fully aware of some of these dangers, and I'm talking specifically about Black voters, young voters, people of color?
Well, we're going to see how successful he is after next Tuesday. But no, I think that the messaging is spot on. I also believe that what he's facing is a landscape where since his election, many, many states have made it harder for the constituency that is his likely voters and the Biden coalition to actually vote. And I do think that there's frustration on the side of some of his constituency that the president and the Democratic Congress and the administration were unable to pass legislative safeguards, the For the People Act, the John R. Lewis Voting Rights Act, to defend that right to vote. So he's caught between a rock and a hard place. And I think on some levels as president, it's hard to use the bully pulpit in this historical context, because before the hyper-partisanship that we're experiencing now, the president was seen as a sort of unifying figure and a figure who, once elections were over, even people who hadn't voted for the president would support the president. Now that most Americans, at least in terms of polling, are identifying with parties so ideologically, there's really much less support of the president as this kind of unifying figure. So in a way, it becomes a base speech in a de facto way.
Unfortunately, we have to leave it there. So much more to talk about. Peniel Joseph is the director of the University of Texas Center for the Study of Race and Democracy. Thank you so much for joining us on Here and Now.
Thank you.
Coming up, slavery is on the ballot in 5 states. Yes, you heard that right. Next week, voters will decide whether the 13th Amendment slavery loophole should be closed. That's after the break. For over 150 years, slavery has been illegal in the United States, with one notable exception. Language in the 13th Amendment outlawed slavery except as a punishment for crime. This year, voters in 5 states, Alabama, Louisiana, Oregon, Tennessee, and Vermont, will decide whether they want to close this slavery loophole. Jane Clayson spoke with Christina Carrega, a national criminal justice reporter for Capital Bee News. She's been covering the story.
I spoke to a gentleman named Curtis Davis with the Abolish Slavery National Network. He's all out of prison at this point and is on the ground in Louisiana, which is one of the states on the ballot, as you mentioned, trying to explain to the voters across the state that this is actually a real thing. And the way it's exploited in prisons around the country is, you know, if you're sick and you don't feel like working, unfortunately, the alternative is these repercussions of intimidation, threats of adding more time back on the person's sentence, removing the reduced good time that they were earning, taking away visitation rights, getting to see and talk to their family over the phone. So they're forced to work in order for them to be there so that they don't have to stay there any longer as an alternative based on this particular clause in every state.
So the loophole actually still exists in many states, 19 states exactly, and there seems to be some confusion among voters who are trying to understand the convoluted language in their states on this ballot question. What are you seeing on these ballots?
Right. So you don't want to be the person in 2022 checking a box and being on the record of saying that you're good with slavery being on your state's constitution. And the wording is so convoluted, it took a couple of times, even in Colorado back in 2018, to get the question right for those voters in that state to get rid of that exception clause. So the big job amongst the advocates with the national organizations who are on the ground in these states is explaining how this wording is put on the ballot so that they understand that they're checking yes or they're checking no, because it could be so confusing. And you find that in a lot of ballot questions outside of even the slavery loophole question in these 5 states.
I see. So other states like Colorado and Utah and Nebraska have actually closed this loophole in recent years. But have these states actually ended the practice of paying people who are in prison low wages or no wages for their work? Has it stopped?
Well, we only know about one particular prison in Lancaster County in Nebraska that reportedly took the wages from zero to at least $30 a week for their incarcerated folks to get paid during that time frame. And also, unfortunately, if there aren't any complaints from those who are incarcerated to say, hey, this is what's going on, advocates, family members, and attorneys won't know whether they should go and investigate, file lawsuits to see what's actually happening in those prisons. So until we hear something, we can't know if it's actually been a policy change or not. But at least we know, at least in one particular prison in Nebraska, they did make the change immediately.
I got about 10 seconds. Do you see federal changes coming surrounding these loopholes? Is federal change needed quickly?
Yes, it's actually a pending bill. The founder of Worth Rises is working on the ground. I spoke with her, and she's pretty much trying to explain this as well, because, again, the exception clause is like one of the biggest open secrets in American history, and it needs to be explained to even the most educated person.
Christina Carrega, national criminal justice reporter for Capital B News. Christina, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up next, we'll hear about Elsie Robinson, a prolific female journalist whose columns critically examine the place of women in society during the early 1900s. Stick around. In the 1900s, Elsie Robinson was one of the most widely read journalists across the country. Through her columns, she reached millions of readers and challenged the status quo around gender and race at the time. But in the years since, her name has fallen into obscurity. A new book seeks to change that. It's called Listen World, after one of Robinson's most popular columns. Jane spoke with Allison Gilbert, one of the co-authors of the book.
Why does Elsie Robinson belong in the pantheon of women we should know about?
She wanted women to have a voice, and she wanted women to have that voice far earlier than most of the champions that we so often point to. For example, she had said back in 1922, more than a decade before Gloria Steinem was even born, that there was a difference between the sexes that have been emphasized and exploited, and that it has built a wall between the sexes, and it was time we knocked it down. And I love that energy, and it's a shame that we don't remember her voice.
Why don't we remember her voice? Why has Elsie Robinson been forgotten?
Oh, we have so many theories, but one of them comes from some really exhaustive research done by the National Women's History Museum. And what they have found is that K through 12 in our public schools, of all the historical figures that are taught, only 24% are women. And so if you're not taught about women's histories, how are we to then pass on these remarkable stories?
And she was a remarkable figure, born and raised in poverty in the San Francisco Bay Area, married as a teenager, escaped a loveless marriage. She was a destitute single mom. She worked in the gold mines of the Sierra Nevada foothills to provide for her son at a time when women weren't supposed to work outside the home at all, of course. Talk about her determination, not just to survive, but to really make something of herself.
I think she wanted to be an artist. She wanted to be a creator. And so for her to want to have this bigger life became more important than even comfort.
But it wasn't easy for her. She moved to San Francisco. She tried to get hired at a newspaper in the Bay Area. She was rejected over and over again. Finally, she was hired at the Oakland Tribune to write a weekly children's column of illustrated animal stories.
She noticed that all the San Francisco papers had a children's section, and she went across the bay and she knocked on that proverbial door, and he hired her. The editor who was there at the time hired her on the spot, and she eventually pivoted to writing for grown-ups.
Yes, and had one of the most popular columns of all times.
It was incredible. She had more than 20 million readers. And just to put that number into perspective, that is double the number today of current subscribers to the New York Times. In nearly every single major city, her byline was read. Hearst in the 1930s had 28 newspapers in 19 cities, and she was not only in all of those, but there were newspapers all over the country that carried Hearst syndicated content, and that's why her readership went sky high.
So Elsie Robinson had her columns, of course, but she covered big events and breaking news, too, right? She covered the Lindbergh kidnapping, among others. And her boss, William Randolph Hearst, insisted she get top placement in all his papers. She actually went to her. She said, "I'm not paid enough. I deserve more." I mean, that's a familiar story to a lot of women who may be listening, underpaid because you're a woman.
She had fortitude. She had grit. What's remarkable to me is that we found, Julia, my co-author, and I found letters in the archive of the William Randolph Hearst papers at the Bancroft Library, actual correspondence between Elsie Robinson and Hearst himself, saying that she was underpaid, worked too hard, not given vacation, that she was somewhat of a factory working for him. And what I love so much about having found these letters in this archive, because there was no Elsie Robinson archive, we actually had to find the information about Elsie Robinson within the archives of the men who employed her. But I love the roadmap that she has left behind for the rest of us. She gathered evidence of her success. So she wasn't just complaining about needing a raise. She showed Hearst himself why she was contributing and how she was contributing to his bottom line. And so I find that to be incredibly instructive. And that's why I think the story is so important, because no matter what you want to do, you want to get paid what you are worth. And I think Elsie Robinson shows how that was done, and done so remarkably well.
That's Alison Gilbert. Her book, written with Julia Shears, is Listen, World, How the Intrepid Elsie Robinson Became America's Most Read Woman. Alison Gilbert, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This podcast comes from the team behind Here and Now, from NPR and WBUR Boston. As always, there's so much more to read and listen to at our website, hereandnow.org. New today, producer Emiko Tamagawa introduces listeners to author Friedrich Buchmann's Bear Town trilogy.
It was me challenging myself as a sports fan, looking myself in the mirror, asking myself, what part of this culture that is not good have I been a part of? What did I let people get away with that I shouldn't have let them get away with?
Today's stories were produced by Shirley Jihad, Thomas Danielian, and Emiko Tamagawa. Todd Munt and Gabe Bullard edited the show. Our technical directors are Max Liebman and Mike Moschetto. Theme music by Max, Mike, and Chris Bentley. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. And the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.